our first talk is by Jacob Collard, and he'll be telling us about natural language processing for sociolinguistic analysis, as you can see. And you probably already know by now that the sessions are 20 minutes with 10 minutes of questions at the end. I guess that's all that really matters, so thanks for coming. Let's all welcome Jacob.
Thank you. As Kevan said, I'm Jacob. I'm a student at Swarthmore College, and I'm going to be describing a methodology for some sociolinguistic analysis and exploring of language endangerment that takes advantage of natural language processing. So first I'll talk about some motivation for this. We want to be able to measure language conservation, and we want to be able to measure language endangerment and figure out what methods for conservation are actually working, and figure out what's going on in a deeper sense. So we really want to know why and how. We don't just want to know which languages are endangered. We want to know how we can deal with that and why they're endangered in the first place. So then I'll talk about some goals that are based off of those motivations. And then I'll go on to explain more about the methodology itself and the natural language processing involved, which takes advantage of LSI, which is latent semantic analysis, and some clustering. And then I'll go through an example of how this methodology can be used on the endangered languages catalog as an example. And then I'll talk about the results that this example produces. So just to give some overview that most of you are probably somewhat aware of, but to give some background to these motivations, language is context dependent. It doesn't just sit in a vacuum. And languages are constantly in flux, having more or less speakers, and various sociopolitical factors, all kinds of different factors that go into everything about language, but in particular language endangerment. So the big question is, what factors help or hinder language conservation, and what factors contribute to language endangerment? We also want to be able to know how endangered a language is. Is this language going to die out in go dormant in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, or is it going to react well to conservation efforts and stay thriving for the indefinite future? But context is very complicated. You can't just state everything about a language in a few words or in a few sentences, and you certainly can't express it very clearly in a numerical value that's easy to work with. You can't just say this language is 75% endangered. That's an essentially meaningless thing to say. So here's just an example of some of the many things that go into determining language vitality. This is provided by UNESCO. But this is just a tiny subset of the various factors that go into it. And you can see how some of these might interact with each other in different ways. So community members have their attitudes toward language, and governments have their attitudes toward language. But community members also have their attitudes towards the government and other institutions that are maybe working for language conservation. And there's lots and lots of interplay, making this a very, very complicated field. Even just measuring language endangerment is very complicated. Various projects have tried to do it to varying degrees of success. This is the UNESCO Atlas of the World's Languages in Danger. This only shows endangered languages, and it gives them a ranking essentially from 1 to 5. Five being extinct, and one being vulnerable. They're marked here on this map in various colors. The Endangered Languages Catalog tries to formalize the method for determining how endangered a language is based off of these four criteria, each of which are assigned a score from 0 to 5. The Endangered Languages Catalog introduces some weighting in favor of intergenerational transmission, because that's deemed to be a very important factor. And you can disagree or agree about how good a system that is, but it is a system, and it takes into account some of the complexity that's involved. But it can't possibly take into account all of the complexity that's involved in language endangerment, and it's still only a measure of how endangered a language is. It's not a measure of why the language is endangered. So we want to look more into the factors that are going into these judgments. So how will speakers react to conservation attempts is an important one. Is anyone willing to support conservation? That is, are there institutions that are willing to work in favor of language conservation? Is the government in support? Are there governments, institutions, private organizations, and our community members willing to react positively to language conservation efforts? But we want to know what else. This is just a tiny subset. Does writing have any influence on it? Education probably does. Demographics might have an influence on it. Ethnic groups, interplay between different ethnic groups or racial groups, and other languages that are involved. I mean, everybody is often talking about how English is having massive impact on the world's languages. Is that something about English, or is it just something about globalization? What is really going on here? And even geography could have an effect. So we want to be able to find out more. How do we learn more about what factors contribute to language endangerment? And of course, linguists are often working with this. Linguists, anthropologists, everybody is working with this. Interviews and surveys, census data, case studies. There's lots of research that goes into factors of language endangerment. But how do we use this data? It takes a long time to collect linguistic data, especially about sociolinguistic contexts. If you do interviews, you're dealing with individuals. If you do census data, maybe you're generalizing too much, and maybe you're working only with very broad data, and it's not focusing on that human level, that human component, and all the complexities that are involved in that. So we really want to know how we use the data that we do get, and how we analyze that in a way that gives us answers to some of these big questions. So we want to know, how do we determine what factors contribute to language endangerment? And we want to know how we use pre-existing data, and in particular metadata about languages. So the metadata I'm referring to here is not necessarily structural properties of the language, but how the language is used, domains of use, how many speakers there are, that kind of metadata. And there is a lot of metadata that exists. Linguists are often going out and marking down metadata about the languages that they're studying. And a lot of that has been collected in large repositories like the Endangered Languages Catalog. But how do we use that data? It exists, but what does it tell us? Ostensibly it looks at individual languages, but can we generalize it more? And how do we remain consistent and scientific while doing this? And we can look at these individual case studies, but that doesn't necessarily have statistical significance. And we want to be able to create globally applicable results to answer questions about language endangerment in general. So our objective, and my objective in developing this methodology, is to go from research to conclusions. And by conclusions, I mean these broader, globally applicable conclusions about language endangerment, not necessarily the specific conclusions about a particular language, which are also valuable, but this methodology's aim is to be able to generalize. And so there's an idea of, we want to go from this linguistic metadata through some methodology to produce conclusions. And the methodology that I'm proposing is some sort of natural language processing to look through that metadata and find insights that we can't find very easily, simply because of the complexity and the amount of data that exists. So given a set of metadata, how do we learn more about it? A very simple, rough way of doing it is just count all the words. And so we can create a matrix like this for a set of documents. And let's say each document represents a language. So D1 is a document about a particular language. D2 is a document about a different language. And we count each of these words in each of those documents. So language one, a particular article about it, mentions the word bilingual 20 times. But in documents 4 and 5, it's never mentioned at all. We can look at this and say, okay, so bilingualism maybe correlates with not being written. These numbers happen to be just made up, but this is the sort of thing that we can look at. And this is useful because it takes this very complicated data and it turns it into numbers, which machines can work with and which statistics can work with. This is not where we want to really go from, because this is very, very rough and not really handling the intricacies of language, because we're just looking at individual words and their frequencies. It completely fails to take into account negation. If you have not bilingual in a text, this is going to read it exactly the same as if it has the word bilingual in a positive sense. But what this does allow us to do is put things on a plot and treat it numerically. And we can say documents 1 and 5 are very far apart. These two blue dots in the lower right corner are very close together. So maybe there's some sort of similarity in the metadata of these two languages. And maybe that similarity can't be noted just by reading the documents, because it's hidden in some things that we as humans don't necessarily pick up right away when we read an article. But as I said, this isn't necessarily the best way to go, because it fails to account for a lot of intricacies. Another solution is latent semantic analysis, or latent semantic indexing, which automatically generates a series of topics about a particular corpus. So given a corpus about languages in danger, for example, it might generate topics that are based off of the frequencies of the words bilingual, multilingual, and monolingual. And so even though these are different words, they're part of the same general semantic domain, so to speak. And this method puts them all together into these domains. And it can also find things that are negatively correlated. So bilingual and multilingual both contribute to a sort of multilingualism domain, whereas monolingual contributes to a monolingual domain in a fairly obvious way here. And we can still rank the documents in exactly the same way as we did with raw word frequencies, and give numerical values to each term, and we can thus continue with our graphical representation and represent things using distance and similarity in a very quantitative manner. And so what I'm kind of doing here is bridging the gap between qualitative research and quantitative research. Because we have a lot of very good qualitative research, but finding the underlying patterns among all of this research is difficult to do. Because if you're doing it manually, you have to read lots and lots and lots of documents. And even then, human memory just has the limitation that you're not going to catch everything about it. But the latent semantic analysis can give us hints, perhaps, in what similarities exist. One thing that we can do that's an advantage of this numerical representation of qualitative data is that we can group coordinates together. So here with these two blue dots, say we had a lot more and there was a large cluster of them there, we can say maybe there's something going on among all of these languages. And there are many different variants of clustering. I won't go into the details of that, but you can look for different types of things using different clustering algorithms. And so all of these numerical representations can be used with clustering. So this is just a visual for some different types of clustering algorithms. And you can see that it divides things in various different ways based off of whether it's a single contiguous group or whether it's separate clusters, as you might think of them more commonly. The exact differences between these different clustering algorithms, I'm not going to talk about them, and they're not really important. And it's a little difficult to really figure out which one to use because our data is very noisy. So I'm now going to talk about how we can actually apply this methodology to linguistics, and in particular language endangerment. And I'm going to be using the example of the Endangered Languages Catalog. I'm not trying to make a value judgment about whether the Endangered Languages Catalog is good or bad. I'm just using it because it has a significant amount of data and it works well with this particular theme. So here's an example of an entry, or part of an entry, from the Endangered Languages Catalog. It cites how threatened the language is, and it gives some various metadata, for example, on language vitality, and it gives a natural language description of the vitality of the language. And so looking through this as a human, it's hard to know really how you would relate this description to another language. You can pick out some obvious things, perhaps, like significant numbers are abandoning their own language, but there's no way of knowing whether you've picked out everything. And we want to be able to find these less obvious relationships between language contexts. The advantages of this, the Endangered Languages Catalog, and also some of the problems that it presents, are that it has data of many different types. So the speaker number, 2,600, is just a raw number, but the vitality information is just a comment. It's just a string of text. But when we use latent semantic analysis to convert this text into a numerical format, it kind of normalizes everything and puts all of the data on the same playing field. There's also an issue that there can be conflicting data in the Endangered Languages Catalog. Two authors might write about the same language. The numerical data also is useful for this, because if they say two things, we can use these numerical values and kind of find the average between them. These numerical values are helping us again, even though there are certainly lots of issues with using vector semantics. They can certainly be helpful in this case. So the kind of results that this shows is kind of an important question. We want to know, if we're going to use this methodology, we want to know what kind of answers we're going to get from it. So the first thing that it does is it shows which languages have similar contexts. It doesn't necessarily state anything about those contexts. It just says, I think these languages are similar. And that's not particularly useful on its own, because why are they similar? Again, we're asking why and how. But luckily, it does show why the contexts are similar. Because latent semantic analysis not only creates these domains of semantic domains, but it also labels them, as I showed before, where it shows what words are going into these domains. And so if you look at two languages after using this methodology, you can see which domains are the reasons they are so similar. It offers two ways of looking at things. You can look at two languages just in relationship to one another. It will say why these languages are similar. You can look at a particular language and find the most similar languages to it. You can also cluster things together and just say all of these languages are similar without starting at any one point. I'm also working on developing a nice clear visualization of this. Using either clustering or the k nearest points, you can create a graphical representation, and I'm working on a JavaScript front end that will allow you to interact with all of these data. But that's still in development. So here's an example of the results that I got from working with the Endangered Languages Catalog. And these are still somewhat preliminary. I haven't gone through the entire results yet, and there is no visualization yet. So it will get easier once that gets done. But you can start looking at some of the things that it can produce. So I told it to produce some clusters. And one of the clusters that it produced contained these three languages, Kalabari, Ikizu, and Takistani, two of which are listed as Niger-Congo languages, and Takistani is listed as an Indo-European language. So you can see why Niger-Congo languages would group together. They're both Niger-Congo languages. And but why is Takistani in there? Well, some of the salient features among these languages were that they had 100 to 200,000 native speakers, that they were all poorly documented. It actually does cluster languages based off of how well documented they are, even though I wasn't using the document indexing in the Endangered Languages Catalog. It just looks at how sure the Endangered Languages Catalog is. And so, in fact, the lack of information in LCAT is contributing to these languages being grouped together. It also thought they were similar in that they had around 500 young adult speakers, and so you can see that even though these languages aren't listed in Endangered Languages Catalog as having low intergenerational transmission, the methodology found that there might be a very small number of young adult speakers relative to the other speakers. a lot of the clusters had geographical and genetic bases. It grouped a lot of Papua New Guinean languages together. It also grouped sign languages together in a lot of cases. One of the downsides was it produced clusters of drastically different sizes. This cluster only had 3 in it. Another cluster had about 50 languages in it. Pidgins and Creoles also clustered together. And this is some, not necessarily the most useful information that this can produce, but it's just an example of the sort of thing that it can find. And that the fact that it's finding these more obvious things is hopefully an indication that it can find other things as well. Similarly, working with the languages that just asked to find the nearest neighbors, it found various things that were varying degrees of obviousness. So it found that these languages were similar. Nambia and Tuvo were similar because they were both spoken along a river, which may or may not actually be useful to you. But LSI is also weak against certain types of synonymy, negation, and phrasal constructs because it's still using just a single words at a time. But it can also work with bigrams and trigrams and higher levels. There's also an issue that if you put garbage into it, it gets garbage out. Again, I'm not trying to say anything about the Endangered Languages Catalog, but and certainly not about the authors that contributed to the Endangered Languages Catalog. But there can be issues with the data that produce issues with the output. So in the future, I hope to develop visualization software for this and improve some of the natural language processing that underlies it. And then the next step is to ask some questions of this methodology and see what more physical, more concrete answers it can produce. Because so far I've been asking it very broadly, language endangerment. And so the software will be released open source very soon. Thank you.
We have about 8 minutes for questions.
Yeah, so currently the model only works with unigrams. It only works with single values, but it's modular enough that by changing one thing in a settings file, I can change it to bigrams. It's also possible to work with multiple models at the same time, so work with n-grams, unigrams and bigrams and trigrams all in the same model.
So I probably missed this section, but I just wanted to clarify the data you're using is it like the source code of the pages? Is it like just the text that's written in all of those pages?
Yeah. So if, for example, with this this page here, where it says more on vitality and it gives that text, it's working with that text.
Okay.
In between the quotes there.
Are you manually choosing which words are going into its semantic
no,
set?
No, it does that automatically. So it searches, it actually searches based off of each field in the Endangered Languages Catalog. So it looks at all of the more on vitality fields in all of the languages among all of the contributors, and it finds features that cluster together.
I was interested that it clustered languages along rivers. And was there anything else really surprising like that it tended to cluster?
That's not a cluster that it found them along rivers. That's given Nambia, what are the nearest languages? So it didn't say this is a significant enough cluster that I want to call it a cluster. It just said the very, very closest language to Nambia is Tuva. And the reason that it's close is partially because they both are spoken along rivers. There is a lot of surprising clusters in there. There's some surprising information. It grouped all of these countries at the bottom together. It decided that all of these belong to the same semantic domain, whereas other countries like the United States are actually counter to that domain. They correlate negatively. And so some of it is a little confusing. And that's why I kind of want to emphasize that this isn't a conclusive methodology, but it might provide some hints into where to look at things.
I have another question for you. So it's really interesting, actually, and I was doing something vaguely relatable in the sense of looking at correlations between metadata, but I'm just curious what you think about the implication of, I mean, you mentioned that your analysis is based on the quality of the data, and I think like it's worth mentioning, not only do you not have to say anything bad about, you know, the people working on the endangered language catalog, but I think it goes to a deeper issue, which is that the people who are collecting the data are different linguists doing it in potentially inconsistent ways, and those numbers of speakers are potentially ranges, and it might be based on, some people might be doing it based on native speakers or, you know, people who are bilingual. So there's all kinds of potential inconsistencies, and I'm wondering, you know, what you think about that. Can this kind of work deal with those issues?
Well, that's a pretty major reason for using latent semantic analysis over just a simple n-gram model, because latent semantic analysis can group things together based off of, even if different authors are using different words for the same thing, it can group those two words together, whereas just a basic n-gram model will separate them.
Okay. But then specifically about the numbers, right? I mean, if it just comes down to a number, and that number is really vague, right? So
yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I don't know if there is even a way of dealing with that. It's a very difficult problem. How do you count languages is something that's widely debated.
Yeah.
Yes?
So as your slide sort of illustrates, coincidence is not causality, of course.
Of course.
And, this is great for finding coincidence, but can you, do you envision being able to extend the system to at least automate a little bit of the winnowing of coincidence from causality?
I would like to be able to. It can certainly find strength of the correlation between languages. So it ranks the similarities between languages numerically. And you can look at that ranking and see, is that a very high correlation between these languages, or is it a very low correlation? And if it's a low correlation, perhaps it's more likely to be coincidence. If it's a much higher number, then perhaps it's not.
But even a high number, the causality may still be unclear or in an unexpected direction.
Yeah, identifying causality is probably not going to happen anytime soon using this methodology. But like I said, if you can find something that might be a coincidence or it might be causality, it's perhaps worth looking into.
And I was wondering, are you planning this to be software designed for people who specialize in natural language processing, or is this going to be designed for people without that kind of background to be able to use it?
It's not designed specifically for people working with natural language processing. It's designed to work in a very simple way, where you have your data and you put it through, and it spits out a visualization, and it spits out all the information that you need with that. The final product that I'm envisioning will not be dependent on any natural language processing knowledge.
Cool. Thank you.
We have time for about one more question.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.